Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. I have SMA Type 2, and I am a columnist and forums director for SMANewsToday.com. Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. And joining me today is returning to the show, Ben Matlin, who is an author and disability rights activist. He was actually the second guest on the show back when I got it started in 2017. So it's been a minute since we got him on. He also contributed to our 31 Days of SMA campaign last year. So we're happy to have him back. So Ben, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We are here to talk as both a follow-up to your original episode, but also you have a book coming out in November about disability pride. And given that July is recognized as Disability Pride Month, we want to talk about that. And so excited to have you back. And before we get started, if everyone could please listen to a brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is brought to you by Genentech, the makers of a treatment for SMA. Whether you are living with SMA or are the parent to a child with SMA, make a choice today that could impact your future. Visit treatmysma.com to see why treatment matters.
Okay. Well, Ben, to get started, so as I mentioned, you know, you've been on the podcast before, but for listeners who may not know you, can you give a little intro to yourself and a little bit about your work?
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be with you again. I am 59 years old with spinal muscular atrophy, type 2, and I grew up in New York. I used a wheelchair my whole life, basically. And I was very fortunate, really, particularly at that time when there was no such thing as disability rights. My parents were able to give me a pretty good, pretty normal upbringing. And I didn't really think much about access issues and stuff like that until I graduated from college and I couldn't get a job. And, I went on interviews and interview after interview got me nowhere except, well, I wanted to try writing. I had written for student newspapers and I thought it was something I could do physically. And one newspaper gave me a writing assignment. And then another one followed and another. Nobody wanted me to work on staff or in their office, but they liked my work well enough to hire me freelance and publish my articles, but they didn't want me around in person. I began to realize that some of the stuff I was hearing from disability rights activists really made sense. You know, it wasn't as crazy as I thought because it was my life. And I began to meet some folks and I liked them and I got involved and I couldn't really believe it when the ADA passed in 1990. And that's 32 years ago already. In the interim, I got married, we had kids. I kind of lost touch with the activist community. I mean, I was online and stuff, but I wasn't really up on, I wasn't really keeping up on what was going on in disability activism. But about, 4 or 5 years ago, Julian Mercado, the actor model, had a big billboard in Times Square for Olay, the beauty brand, and Aerie, the lingerie brand of American Eagle, used a bunch of models with various disabilities and chronic health conditions. Ali Stroker won the Tony, a paraplegic performer. And I thought, wow, something has changed. Either the world has changed or disabled people have done something to get through the gatekeepers. And there was lots of talk about how inspirational all this was and blah, blah, blah. I didn't buy that. To me, I saw a shift in attitudes and a real righteous expression of disability pride. And so I proposed the book, and I sold the idea to kind of explore what has happened since the ADA. How did we get to this point? I wanted to connect the dots and better understand my community and where it was going. And what I learned, it was really kind of profound for me. You know, I thought I knew what disability pride was. I thought it was not being ashamed of yourself, your body, your mind, the way you operate and function. I thought it was not trying to hide or minimize your limitations. I even thought it was about not spending any too much energy waiting for a cure, you know, that we're okay as we are, don't need to be fixed. Well, all that's true. But I also learned a great deal about the community and the history. And I found that I should have known this, but I didn't know. There are disabled people everywhere, all sorts, you know, all colors and geographies and races and orientations and genders and socioeconomic backgrounds and so forth. And they're all doing stuff, you know, they're all engaged in one way or another. They have lives. And in fact, disabled people always have contributed to society. And the more I learned about this, the more I realized, you know, it almost can't help feeling proud to be a member of that club. It isn't, for me, disability pride isn't just about how you feel about yourself and your disability. It's recognizing your connection, your kinship with others, with your siblings, your peers, your ancestors, and all we disabled people have done and continue to do to contribute to the world in many, many different ways.
That's fantastic. And
that's the end of my speech.
No, it's a great speech. And I love it. I mean, you hit on a lot of the questions I was going to ask anyway. But speaking of it, so, you know, July is recognized as Disability Pride Month. And I love kind of that summary of, you know, unpacking what that means to you. What were some of the things you learned about the history of Disability Pride Month and in Pride in general in writing this book?
Well, you know, there are people like Harriet Tubman, who led the Underground Railroad, or Sojourner Truth, who was a big, you know, anti-abortion, early civil rights activist. They both had disabilities. Marsha Johnson, I think I had the name right, who was an important person in the Stonewall Uprising and galvanized gay rights, lived with disabilities and was a real advocate for things like access to medical care and not enforcing medical treatments on people without consent. And these people didn't identify as disability activists, but they were, in a way. They are our models. They are ancestors of the movement. And it's not just the famous people, you know. There are a lot of people who've been sort of erased from the record or don't receive attention in the spotlight who matter, who do important things, even if it's only for a few friends or if it's, you know, you can be active lying in your bed if you need to be. Doesn't mean you're out there in the spotlight moving the world. And there's so many ways that there's so many things that disabled people do. You know, there are, well, it's hard to name names. I'll leave somebody out. You know, there are clothing companies that make garments just for disabled bodies. There are obviously writers and poets and singers and just regular folks. But there's also a lot of activism. I learned, for instance, in I guess the early 2000s, well, before that, in the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of attention on autism. I may have started with the movie Rain Man with Dustin Hoffman, which for a lot of non-autistic people was an introduction to autism. It was a best-selling book by Temple Grandin, who talked about her upbringing with autism, although she said a lot of things she took back later. But there was scientific stuff. People were finding that there were a lot more autistic people in the world that had been recognized. It was a broader category of situations. There was a piece in the Atlantic Monthly magazine about geek pride, that there are people we call geeks. It mentioned Bill Gates, I believe, who it suggested may be autistic. It's not some weird disease, that it's just a fact of biology, that there are people whose brains work differently. There was also a bogus report about vaccines causing autism, but that was completely debunked as a made up and nonsensical. But in the early 2000s, a bunch of mostly young autistic adults said all this stuff is about finding a cure. It's all medical. It's not about making our lives better. It's not about, well, they're basically like the disability rights movement. We need access to, we need environments and educational practices that are accessible for autistic minds. And they some debate about where it came from, but the word neurodiversity was created to refer to the kind of range of ways that people's brains work, the way we function. It kind of got extended to certain emotional and psychiatric disabilities, PTSD and ADHD and bipolar disorder, because there are all different ways that people's brains function. So that was the whole rights movement I had not really known about. Also early in the 2000s, a group of activists, mostly in the San Francisco area, started drawing attention to the way the people, the ADA, did not really cover the protection or where the disability rights movement had failed, particularly the intersectional issues facing disabled people of color or queer disabled people, who had sort of a double whammy of prejudices and injustices, and they call it the disability justice campaign. That term is often misused, I found. I thought it was just a hip new way of referring to disability rights, but the disability justice people have some very specific points they make. For instance, that ableism overlaps with racism and colonialism, and they're anti-capitalist, because the capitalist system is about competing one person up, another person down, and that invariably hurts disabled people. So there was a whole movement there that I don't fully understand. I tried my best to talk to people, quote people, or quote what they've published, posted, other interviews they've done, to get it in their own words. I am not talking for them. I'm trying to, in my book, I'm trying to create a space for their voices to be heard by more people. It is my privilege to have access to this media, and if I have readers, well, I don't want to overlook those folks who have been perhaps overlooked before, but I'm not trying to speak for them. I can't represent people whose, you know, my life has been different, but all I can do is report on what they tell me and what I've read that they've written. So those were two big movements that I really had to get up to speed on. And there's other stuff, healthcare disparities and institutionalization, the right to die movement and the not dead yet cause, and a lot of stuff that still is going on that the ADA does not address. Sorry, I've gone on too long.
No, that's fantastic. And I think it is very much, as you point out, with the disability rights movement, like any movement, it's constantly evolving. And the ADA was a major step, but so much has been done and recognized since then. But absolutely. Well, Ben, before we continue, if everyone could please listen to one more brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is made possible by Genentech, the makers of a treatment for SMA. If you are living with SMA, the subtle changes that happen from one day to the next can be hard to notice until a key function is lost. Many people find that these changes can impact their life, not just physically, but also emotionally. Since the progression of SMA is relentless, taking action now is important. If you've waited to go on treatment or were told there were no treatments for you, now might be the time to talk to your doctor. Breakthroughs in science have led to more options than ever before in treatment and care. Choosing a disease-modifying treatment can make a difference. Why wait? Visit treatmysma.com to see why treatment matters.
Okay, so in terms of the structure of this book, so first of all, what's the full title?
Disability Pride, Dispatches from a Post-ADA World.
I love it. Oh, that's great. And so your first two books, I know when we last had you on, I think your second one was about to come out. That was on a series. It was a book about interabled relationships. And so, and then your first book was a memoir about your life. With this one, what's kind of the structure? But I mean, because I imagine, again, it's a lot of history. It's a lot like your second book, the one on relationships, was this collection of stories of couples you talk to. With this one, is it like, are you trying to give kind of an overall history while also including all these stories? What was kind of the structure and the process of putting it all together?
Well, I made sure to keep myself out of it as much as possible. As I say, to let other people talk. The first section is a bit of history. The first, I don't know, third of the book. What led up to the ADA and what where it's succeeded and where it's failed, and kind of the birth of disability pride, what it means and how it was expressed. For instance, I go into the history of disability studies, you know, as a curriculum, which is big now. There are hundreds of classes and courses around the world, but it didn't exist when I was in school. It's only since the ADA. And that's helped a lot of young people understand disability in a social, political, cultural context as opposed to a medical context. So that's the first third of the book, that kind of background fundamental stuff. The middle third is about representation, disability online, social media, blogging, gaming, and the ways that interacting online, expressing activism online, has given people a sense of community and helped some people gain a sense of disability pride. People who didn't know any other disabled folks, they go online and wow, there's a community. You know, I'm not some weirdo oddball or whatever. A lot of people like me out there. So that's part of it. Then I go into the media, movies, TV, comedy, stand-up comics, models, the sort of politics of beauty, how our understanding of what's attractive has changed and why representation matters. So it's a whole bunch of stuff about presentation and representation. The last third is about activism. And there's some pretty shocking stuff, I think, about healthcare disparities, for instance. I think the average person assumes that one place disabled people are treated fairly is, you know, in the medical setting. Not true. There's a lot of access barriers. There's a lot of misunderstanding or prejudice from doctors and nurses and others. And there are surveys to show that. And there are some terrible things. People who suffer or even die because of poor medical care, because the medical professionals figured, he or she is, or they are disabled anyway, so we don't need to bother treating them the way we would somebody non-disabled. That became very clear in the worst of the COVID pandemic. And there's a bit about the ongoing problem of deinstitutionalization and funding Medicaid to allow people to live at home and have personal assistance services, an ongoing problem, problems of employment and the persistence of sub-minimum wage and sheltered workshops. I go into where that came from, how they started, and some of the efforts to undo this, because it's, you know, it's legal in most of the country, perfectly legal to pay disabled people pennies an hour for basic labor. And it really ought to be, it ought to not be legal. And then toward the end, I kind of ask, well, I kind of examine what needs to happen to make things better and fairer. If the ADA can't do it, is better media presentation good enough? Or are there ways that the movement has been lacking in getting the message across to the public? I forgot to mention airlines. You know, the airplanes are exempt from the ADA and their efforts to change that, but the results can be quite serious. There was a woman who died last year when her wheelchair got damaged, and they took the time about replacing it, and she developed infections. And I mean, this stuff is serious. So, you know, bottom line, I've come a long way, and there's still a long way to go.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, we were just talking about airline stuff right before recording, and that's one of many issues. But that's really fascinating to hear. Yeah, that's what I was curious about, was like the structure and how encompassing it is of just the different facets of the movement. So that's really cool to see. And on that note too, were there any, like, are there any, speaking of like disability representation in media, you know, actors, comedians, social media influencers, et cetera, are there any, I mean, I know there's a lot, but are there any right now, either that you learned about through writing this book or that you just followed for a while, that really stick out to you and you'd love to spotlight?
Yeah. As I said, I don't want to leave anybody out. You know?
Oh, sure.
Without your names. But I enjoyed writing about the comedy because it was fun. I like to make people laugh. And it made me laugh. Going back to the Callahan cartoons, which is going back a few years. But for a lot of people, that was kind of the first real realization that there is humor in disability. You know, we deal with a lot of things. It's just you have to laugh. But there are, well, all right. You know, Josh Blue, a guy with CP, won Last Comic Standing, 10, 15 years ago. Uh-huh. He's still out there performing. He told me, he said after he won, he was out one night, went to an open mic night at a comedy club, and there were four or five other folks with CP waiting to get on stage. He said, they wouldn't have had the courage or the thought of actually getting a spot on stage if I hadn't done my thing. It opened up doors for people. There are folks on YouTube, Zach Anna, who's gone beyond YouTube, got a deal from Oprah for a series that didn't last, but he has a lot of followers. I could go on and on.
Yeah.
May soon say it. There's a comedian, actor, activist. I mean, she really doesn't, she doesn't, she speaks truth to power. And that's part of it too. You know, through comedy, you can advance a cause. I kind of compare it to the medieval or the Shakespearean court fool, you know, who can tell the king things that nobody else could because it's done in an amusing way and can be enlightening. So there's a lot of power, I think, in this show telling it's just entertainment, but I think it's more than that.
There's so many out there. And Josh Blue, my brother and I saw him perform a few years ago and got to meet him after. He's hilarious. But like you said,
He was nice enough to talk to me for a good, hour or something. And he's a good guy.
That's awesome. That's really cool. I mean, I imagine it's extensive, both on the research side of things and just conducting interviews with people and meeting all these influencers and artists out
there.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, Ben, I thank you so much for coming on today, and it's fantastic. And when does the book come out?
Oh, not till November 15th.
Okay,
But it is available for pre-order. Perfect. Now, wherever books are sold, wherever that may be. And pre-orders are good because they tell the publisher and the booksellers, you know, to push it, to stock it, to advertise it. So get your pre-orders in.
Absolutely. We'll leave the pre-order link in the description. And then also you can be found on social media, and your website is just benmatlin.com.
Correct.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Ben, thank you so much again, and I wish you best. I hope this book does really well, and it's really exciting to see coming out. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. This has been fun.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And for our listeners out there, you can find more stories and conversations like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast. You can also connect with us directly on our forums and follow our main website for all the latest news and perspectives at smanewstoday.com. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time. Take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com. And be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.